wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and streaming at kboo.fm. This is Lori Mercier, your co-host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I happily say co-host because I'm here with Norm Diamond, a longtime member of the Old Mole Collective, agitator, organizer, historian. Welcome back, Norm.
Thank you, Lori. It's nice to be here, and I'm pleased to be doing this with you. And I'll even explain why later on when we get to our subject themes.
Okay. Each Monday morning, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The Mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority, and giving voice to the movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. Today, we look at one of those grassroots movements, the labor movement, and its role and potential, past and present, in expanding economic justice and popular democracy, and what lessons we can learn from past and current struggles. We begin with the Mole's Fran Michel, who tells us what hashtag MeToo can teach the labor movement. Then I talk with Norm about what we can learn about labor history and from contemporary labor activists about how to expand workers' power, coming out of his recent Labor History for Labor Activists course. Finally, to conclude the show, the Mole's Clayton Morgridge tells us why we need more than voting rights in the Democratic Party to expand political power to the many. Patsy Kohlberg is our engineer. And as always, you can subscribe to the Old Mole podcast by going to our kboo.fm. And you can also find there links to past shows and segments. You can contact us through that page or on Gmail at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. So Norm, tell us about the music we're going to hear on today's show.
Well, we picked some music, Lori, that's appropriate to our theme about labor. The music is going to center, well, we've got two different sources. One of them is a contemporary rock opera based on the Seattle General Strike in 1919, the centenary of which is, of course, coming up. So we'll hear two cuts from that rock opera, Seattle 1919. And I'm going to hold off on actually introducing them because I want to say something about each of the cuts. They're interesting. They're significant. And the other piece of music that we will hear, we'll do that as you and I talk about labor history, is a recording of blues, but from Detroit. Detroit blues are very specific and they're labor focused. And that's going to be very interesting to listen to, please, Mr. Foreman, in blues. But right now, let's begin with Fran Michel talking about not only the Me Too movement, but Me Too and labor. Labor's our theme for today.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel with some thoughts drawn mainly from an article by Jane McAlevey from In These Times about what Me Too can teach the labor movement. McAlevey notes that behind the recent headlines about sexual harassment lies sexism, misogyny, and contempt for women. Whether in the workplace or in the labor movement, sexual harassment isn't really about sex. It's about a disregard for women, and it shows itself numerous ways. For the Me Too movement to become a meaningful movement, it has to focus on actual gender equality. Lewd stories about this or that man's behavior might make compelling reading, but they sidetrack the real crisis, and they're being easily manipulated to distract us from the solutions women desperately need. Until we effectively challenge the ideological underpinnings beneath social policies that harm women and hem them in at every turn in this country, we won't get at the root cause of the harassment. This requires examining the total devaluation of so-called women's work, including raising and educating children, running a home, and caring for the elderly and the sick. The activities McAleavy points to are those of social reproduction, the arena of reproducing the labor power that creates value in capitalism, that is, of reproducing and sustaining people. As Tithi Bhattacharya puts it, if, according to Marxist theory, workers' labor produces all the wealth in society, who then produces the worker? Put another way, what kinds of processes enable the worker to arrive at the doors of her place of work every day so that she can produce the wealth of society? Silvio Federici notes that the concept of social reproduction stresses that the reproduction of the workforce also takes place outside of the home, in schools and hospitals, for instance. But, Federici points out, reproduction has two sides, in contradiction with each other. On the one hand, it reproduces us as people, and on the other, it reproduces us as exploitable workers. The question is how to turn reproductive work into a reproduction of our struggle. McAleavy stresses that the union movement must step in now and connect the dots to real solutions, such as income supports like universal high-quality childcare, free health care, free university and paid maternity and paternity leave. We need social policies that allow women to be meaningful participants in the labor force. But sexist male leadership inside the labor movement is also a barrier at getting at these very solutions. McAleavy suggests that such leaders fail to recognize the value of organizing over mobilizing and advocacy. They tend to fetishize the factories where blue-collar men produce material goods and fail to see the importance of the white-collar and pink-collar workforce in schools, universities, nursing homes, and hospitals, devaluing as women's work the so-called public sector. McAleavy stresses that capitalism is one economic system, period. The fiction of these seemingly distinct sectors is primarily a strategy to allow corporations to feed off the trough of taxpayer money and pretend they don't. This master lie enables austerity, which is turning into a tsunami post-tax bill. And yet white, male, highly educated labor strategists routinely say that we need totally different strategies for the public and private sector. Hogwash, says McAleavy. This deeply inculcated sexist thought, conscious or not, is holding back our movement and contributing to the absurd notion that unions are a thing of the past. But the forthcoming Supreme Court ruling on NLRB versus Murphy Oil will prove most of the non-union so-called innovations moot. Murphy Oil is a complicated legal case that boils down to removing what are called the Section 7 protections under National Labor Relations Act and preventing class action lawsuits. Murphy Oil blows a hole through the legal safeguards that non-union workers have enjoyed for decades, eviscerating much of the tactical repertoire of so-called alt-labor, such as class action wage theft cases and workers participating in protests called by non-union community groups in front of their workplaces. The timing is horrific and uncanny. Just as women are finally finding their voices about sexual harassment at work, mostly in non-union workplaces, as the majority are, Murphy Oil will prevent class action sexual harassment lawsuits. The central lesson the labor movement should take from the Me Too movement is that now is the time to reverse the deeply held notion that women, especially women of color, can't build a powerful labor movement. Corporate America and the right wing are out to destroy unions, in part so that they can further decimate the few public services that do serve working class families, including Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and public schools. Movements won these programs when unions were much stronger. It makes sense that unions and the women's movement should throw down hardest to defend and grow these sectors, largely made up of women, mostly women of color, who are brilliant strategists and fighters. The labor movement should also dispense with the belief that organizing and strikes can't work. Unions led by Chicago teachers and Philadelphia and Boston nurses, among others, prove this notion wrong. The growing economic sectors of education and healthcare are key. These workers have structural power and extraordinary social power. Each worker can bring along hundreds more in their communities. Another key lesson for labor is to start challenging the inept leadership in the Democratic Party by running its own pro-union rank-and-file sisters in primaries against the pro-corporate Democrats in safe Democratic seats, a target-rich environment. Those who marched with women last January should demand that gender-focused political action committees, such as Emily's List, use support for unionization as a litmus test for whether politicians running for office will get their support. It's time for unions to raise expectations for real gender equality. to channel the new battle cry to rid ourselves of today's sexual harassers into a movement for the gender justice that women in much of Europe already enjoy. To think of winning what have become almost normal gains in many countries, year-long paid maternity and paternity leave, free childcare, health care in universities, 6 weeks annual paid vacation is not pie in the sky. To fight for it, people have to be able to imagine it. Unions, warts and all, are central to a more equal society because they bring structural power and collective solutions to problems that are fundamentally societal, not individual. Women in the United States are stuck with bosses who abuse them because to walk out could mean living in their cars or on the streets or taking two full-time jobs and never spending a minute with their kids. Similarly, women are stuck in abusive marriages because the decision to stop the beating means living on the streets. European women from countries where union contracts cover the vast majority of workers don't, to the same extent, face the decision of losing their husband's health care plan, or not having money to pay for childcare, or so many of the challenges faced by women here. This country is seriously broken, and to fix it, we must build the kind of power that comes with high unionization rates, which translate into political, not just economic power. Naming and shaming is not sufficient. Women need to translate the passion of the Me Too movement into winning the solutions that will help end workplace harassment. It's going to take a massive expansion of unions again, like what happened in the 1930s, the last time unions were declared dead, before we can translate Me Too into a demand that raises all workers' expectations that this country can be a far more equal society. If we commit to this goal, we can achieve it. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel, reading from the work of Jane McAlevey.
Thank you, Fran. This is Norm Diamond. I'm back with Laurie Mercier. Here we are having a program devoted pretty much to labor themes. We're going to be talking about labor history as well as the show goes on. Meanwhile, here's one of the songs that played in the recent course, Labor History for Labor Activists, that we'll be talking about. This is a song from the rock opera, 1919. Some of our listeners will be familiar with the Brecht poem, A Worker Reads History. The point of that poem is, of course, that when you read history, it's all these great men who do this and that and accomplish this and that. And Brecht says, a worker reads that and says, well, who actually did the work? Here, with a brilliant take on that, is a song, Street Speech, from the rock opera Seattle 1919, in which Anna Louise Strong, a great Seattle radical activist at this point working for the newspaper, the Union Record, gives a speech with the same theme as the Brecht poem. So, Street Speech. Listen and hear what she's saying about history and how to understand history.
They say the do you think one pharaoh dropped one bead of sweat? We built the pyramids for the pharaohs, and we're building for them yet. Oh, my sisters, oh, my brothers, we've been building for these others. I think it's time we kept it for ourselves. We don't want them, we don't need them, these parasites who live off someone else. Better turn it around, take another look. Forget what they made you read in your history books. Brick by brick, nail by nail, we built their mansions and we built the jails. Aristotle, noble Plato, these were Greece's glory, we've all read. Philosophic conversation, while the slaves to the land and baked their bread. Oh, my sisters, oh, my brothers, we've been caring too long for these others. I time we took care of ourselves. We don't want them, we don't need them. These parasites who live off someone else, better turn it around, take another look. Forget what they made you read in your history books. Brick by brick, nail by nail, we built the mansions and we built the jails.
Such a great song, Norm.
I'm glad you like it.
From the rock opera, Seattle, 1919.
By the Fuse, a group that was formed in order to make specifically that album.
And we want to come back to the Seattle General Strike of 1919 and why
and
you
to
might
some of that
have
music.
And why you might have selected that music. But tell us about this remarkable labor history class that you taught in November with rank and file activists. Tell us about the genesis of the course and how you collaborated with Portland Rising of Jobs with Justice to get it going.
October and November, actually, but a limited number of classes, which is already an interesting kind of decision. Jobs with Justice, I hope our listeners know what that organization is. It's a coalition of a lot of groups in town, and it tries to emphasize the commonality of struggles and bring people out for each other's struggles, bring groups out for each other's. Within J with J, there's a committee, Portland Rising, that I think goes a little bit further in its intentions, and that's really to emphasize that each one of our struggles is all of our struggles. And so the course came about by thinking, wouldn't it be very interesting, wouldn't it be important even, wouldn't it be a contribution to bring together rank and file activists, people who spend their free time trying to build some kind of an alternative within labor, most of them thinking in terms of changing the society, you know, going much beyond simply building unions or simply building the kind of unions that we have. Wouldn't it be interesting to bring together people from different workplaces, from different unions, in a common kind of project? And so that's the genesis of the course.
So why labor history? Why did the group decide to focus on history?
There are a lot of answers to that question. But one of them is that it's always easier to deal with contemporary concerns, with our problems, by looking first at some other time or some other place. People get the principles and then figure out how to apply them to their own situation. I want to tell you how I began the course, even. It was not so much with history as with just looking at our surroundings, our city, how a labor historian would look at the city. So it took them on an imaginary walk through the city. We actually stayed in the same room. Some people closed their eyes, some people didn't. And we moved around this familiar city, familiar to everybody in the group. The first level was, of course, the sites of great labor events. so that there are lots. Of course, Portland is rich with labor events, many of them struggles, many of them strikes. But so in our imagination, we went out to Pier Park and looked at the site of the 1934 longshore struggle, and Pier Park in particular, where there are bullet holes in the trees from the police coming through on a train, shooting up at the strikers, and the next day the strikers succeeding in stopping the train, which was bringing in scabs to try to break the strike. Or we went into Northwest Portland, again in our imagination, and looked at the site where the unions in town put out their own daily newspaper during the great Oregonian and Oregon Journal strike of 1959 to 1964. And there are many of those kinds of episodes. And then we went to another level, which was just going around the city and looking at, well, looking extensively at buildings and thinking to ourselves, who actually did that work? Who built them? Who works in them now? Is that work gendered? Was the building of them gendered? Etc. Trying to imagine the work and the way that work itself has changed. And that, of course, is one of the motifs of the course, is the way in which the possibilities for organizing stem from also the way in which work has changed, and even who should control the way that work changes and technological innovation.
I was going to say, just with, in terms of physical space, too, just change over time and thinking about how the city's become more gentrified and how certain sites closer in were very much sites of working class struggle and where working people lived, and how that has changed certainly in the last few decades.
And continues, right, and continues to change. And then the third level we went to, and this was unexpected by people in the class, I think, was to look back at decisions that have been made in working class communities about our surroundings. And I mean actual decisions. And so the example that I started out with was Andrew Carnegie coming to Portland around the turn of the 20th century and proposing to build Carnegie Libraries. And Andrew Carnegie, of course, had been the steel magnate who broke the Homestead Strike, who broke unions in steel. And here, late in life, he's feeling philanthropic. And so he comes to Portland, as he comes to every place in the country, and says, I want to build you libraries. I will pay for the libraries. The question, do we accept? And so we had a kind of simulation where we were the organized workers from that time period. We were the typographers and we were the brewers, etc. And do we accept this money? What's very interesting, and there are other decisions like that, of course, that the working class in this town has weighed in on. I'll give you another example in a minute. Some places in the country refused. They said, this is blood money. Wheeling, West Virginia, the organized labor movement there said, no, we're not going to take Carnegie's money. We have a different route. We want a library. We want it in our working class community. In fact, we're literate. We read, we workers, but we're not going to take it from Carnegie. Portland, as it turns out, has six libraries within its boundaries that Carnegie built. Those of you who know the library system out there, North Portland Library is a Carnegie library. Tidal Wave, where the library gets rid of its excess books, was built by Carnegie, etc. There are a few. Another example would be our park system here in Portland. These great parks that we have, the Olmsted brothers came to Portland and sold the parks that they designed for Portland based on, we need to have some way to diffuse working class militancy. And so we're going to build these parks for you. Do you accept this? And there was an opportunity for workers weighing in. And of course, the city went quite along with it. And we've got great parks that, in fact, we use as workers, not only for recreation, but we rally, of course. And there are many labor events that use them. But that's the origin of great parks we have, like Selwood Park would be an example, that was built specifically to undermine working class militancy. So that's how we began the course.
It seems to me that's a great way to think about the past and the present, to just look around at the physical spaces in which we reside. So these were working people, activists who had limited time. How did you decide on what topics to focus in the short amount of time that you had together?
Yeah, we initially set out to have only five classes. That's a ridiculously small amount of time, of course, to try to talk about labor history. In fact, it ended up being seven, and I'll say how that happened. But even so, same problem. And so the course had to be organized thematically, not simply chronologically, but thematically. And we did that by taking iconic kind of labor events from the past for at least the first three classes. So we went through, you mentioned the Seattle General Strike. We did the Bread and Roses strike before that. In the 30s, we looked at the longshore struggle in Portland, and we looked at a sit-in by the women who worked in retail in Woolworth in Detroit. And from that point on, but what we were doing in looking at the history really was looking at kind of strategic choices that are made. And that's part of what's unique about working with labor activists and how the course could be very different from what would happen with a different group, high school group or a college group. These were all people who had to face the same kinds of choices that they saw being made in the past. And so looking at the history really expanded their sense, or was designed to expand their sense, and I think it worked, of what the alternatives were.
So they immediately recognized those kinds of choices and tactic strategies that people then faced and chose, given the circumstances. And they saw themselves as facing similar sets of circumstances.
That was the idea. Immediately, I'm not entirely sure, because, of course, the range of possibilities was so much greater at different times and is now so much greater than people realize. There are many different kinds of labor organizations that can be built, and there are many different visions of what a union can be, beyond even the kinds of unions that we have. So the idea was, yes, you're right, they absolutely identified with the organizers of those different times and places, but as well expanded their sense of the potential by looking at the tough choices, the dilemmas that people had to make in the past. Dilemmas around who's organizable, who's important to organize, what kind of an organization are we building, and really toward what.
And there we can see perhaps greater differences between then and now, and maybe you could say something about the kinds of participants in this course. I mean, what kinds of unions and workplaces they come from, and how that is different from some of those iconic events that you focused on, the longshore strike and the Bread and Roses strike.
And different from even just a few years ago. You know, what I think of as our recent past, I did something similar in the early 80s here in town, brought people together from 17 different unions, rank and file activists, locally. They all were from manufacturing, and that was very, very interesting to see the way in which nobody from this course now, our course in 2017, came out of manufacturing. There were carpenters, there were people, there was SEIU, there were people engaged in the Burgerville organizing, people engaged in New Seasons organizing, teachers from the Nurse Association, from the electrical workers, etc., as well as a couple of people from union-related, from labor-related organizations, not unions, like Jobs with Justice itself, or like Oregon Fair Trade. So these were all activists in labor, but a very different kind of cohort from what had been before.
Well, as Fran Michel mentioned in reading from the Jane McAlevey piece, Jane McAlevey points out that the new factory floors, the hospital and the school, that the nature of work has changed, and so the labor movement has got to catch up with this new kind of workforce and the possibilities that the female and people of color who dominate the memberships of these unions have to offer.
And perhaps we have to do more than just build the same kinds of unions, but with a different demographic. Maybe this raises the possibility of building even different kinds of unions, different kinds of workplace-oriented organizing efforts.
Well, Norm, maybe it's time for another music break. Patsy, if we could cue up the song from Joe Lee Carter, Please, Mr. Foreman.
This is Detroit Blues, and actually where we went to after those iconic struggles that I mentioned was looking at the UAW, the automobile workers in Detroit, as representing all the kinds of possibilities that came out of World War II. We can come back to that, but here's Please, Mr. Foreman.
That was Joe Lee Carter, Please, Mr. Foreman. And Norm, as Mr. Carter sang, why don't you slow down your assembly line? Lord, you can look at me and see I don't mind working. Lord knows I do mind dying.
And you know, that's the title of a brilliant book in labor history about the League of Revolutionary Black Workers by Dan Georgiakis, Marv Serkin, Detroit, I Do Mind Dying. Great book in labor history, but about the African-American struggle within the automobile workers, the resistance to the kind of union that had been built just in the 20 previous years coming out of World War II.
And speaking of the United Auto Workers, the UAW, that was one of your class activities, was a simulation or a role play of the auto workers' shop floor and militant activists and how they participated in the new labor management regime that was trying to assert itself after World War II. Do you want to say something about why you selected that event or that scenario and what the participants in the workshop took away from it?
And why we did it as in the form of a role play also. Yeah, that it's a decisive time period, I believe. The kind of unions that we have now were shaped by the decisions made coming out of World War II. There were vast possibilities then. There had been a major worker organizing upsurge, of course, in the 30s. And during wartime, labor was in a very strong position. So coming out of World War II, there were a lot of choices to be made. too many. I don't like teaching just by lecturing. I didn't have a good reading that would go over that range of possibilities the way I wanted. And so I thought a role play, but a role play also would take people inside the situation of having to make those choices themselves. And the choices are on the order of, well, we've been working till now using direct action. If something happens in the workplace and we don't like it, we directly confront the foreman, or we walk out, or we call a larger strike for the whole enterprise, you know, all the workers there. But what's replacing that now is a very formal, legalized system. You file grievances, and they go through various levels, and months later they may be dealt with, or maybe they're just a bargaining chip that the company, in the case of, say, one of the automobile companies, you get thousands of grievances accumulated, and the union says, okay, well, we'll withdraw these grievances in exchange for some other concession. Very different system from the kind of direct action that workers were used to at that point. Or another very topical now kind of decision to be made coming out of World War II, what about healthcare? What about the welfare benefits? In Europe, those are all being pushed as countrywide. Everybody is entitled to healthcare. You get these systems in Scandinavia and Germany that are nationwide. So in this country, do we want to go for that? Or do we want to go through just the employer and win it just for our workers? With the sense, you have to say, with the sense that we believe these will be spread to other employers, that the economy will grow, that eventually the unions making this decision thought that everyone still, we'd have national health care, it would just be done by a different vehicle.
And of course, in hindsight, of course, workers at the time didn't recognize just how quickly and effectively manufacturers and employers mobilized to resist these kinds of reforms that were taking place in other Western democracies.
Well, there are a few things to say about that. In the United States, we have the strongest ruling class in the world, also the most aggressive. And that reinforces your point. In Europe, the ruling class came out of World War II, both split and compromised by their various kinds of ambivalences around Nazism. The ruling class in the United States was absolutely triumphant. So that's one thing. Another is, I would not say that workers or the working class thought or misestimated. I think union leaderships in particular came out with kind of a myopic view that the upsurge, for instance, in auto sales, we're talking about UAW, would just continue, you know, from the 40s, early 50s, and already by the mid-50s, of course, you're starting to see the import of Japanese and German cars, and that upsurge doesn't just continue the way they had forecast. They based their strategy, and again, this is union leadership, because these decisions were very controversial within the union. They based their strategies on a misunderstanding of, really, of the nature of capitalism. They didn't anticipate the kinds of down cycles that would affect the organizing possibilities. They didn't anticipate the growth of competition through a globalized capitalism.
Norm, we should interject here that people are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Laurie Mercier talking with Norm Diamond about his recent Labor History for Labor Activists course sponsored by Jobs with Justice. So, Norm, in just some of the remaining time that we have, this seems like it was a wonderful course that should be continued. What a great organizing vehicle for many kinds of communities and grassroots groups in addition to labor. But what would you say you learned from this process, from these activist workers?
Well, there are a few things I want to say kind of in summary. It sounds like that's what we're leading to. One is, of course, that the course was filmed. We should say that. And it's in an editing process now. And the idea initially was to have it available for national distribution. And it will be. And it will be on local cable as well. So that's one thing maybe for people to keep in mind, that this will be available for viewing. Another thing is that the emphasis very much, we haven't said that so much in our talking now, was on strategic thinking. And that's something that I see an absence of in in left activity, in our movement, and within labor, actually thinking about what our objectives are that go beyond the simplistic and how to act in a way that enables us to accomplish them. So the entire focus was, we talked before about the different kinds of objectives, different kinds of organizations you might build, but really want to add toward what? What is it that we're after? And how do our efforts now relate to that toward what? For most of the people in the course, and this was a wonderful takeaway, a wonderful experience for me, it was a great group, a thoughtful group of people who are actively engaged as well. And so the thoughtfulness has a kind of feedback loop for them. They change their activity. They change the way they present themselves to other workers based on the thoughtfulness, based on what they were learning in the course too. And that in turn shapes the way that they, I mean, their practice then in turn shapes the way that they think about things. And so seeing some of those changes in people, seeing some of the broadened sense of possibility for not only social possibilities, but for themselves and ways that they could reach out to others. Some of the people have been asked, some of the participants in the class have been asked by their unions to give workshops based on what they learned in this course. Others are incorporating some of what they learned into their own organizing efforts. I hear back from people, and of course, I have some invitations to come in and continue working with some of them. So all that's great fun.
So knowing something about the Seattle General Strike of 1919, 100 years ago, actually helps one in their strategic thinking?
Boy, you know, it shows the possibilities in Seattle, and of course in Winnipeg just a few weeks later, workers take over and run the town completely and do a whole lot better job of it than what had been happening before in the conventional administrations.
Well, I think that is part of the value of history, that it really opens up possibilities. It helps us imagine what could be, because certainly people of the past have imagined much greater things than we think that we're capable of.
We're living in a time of very narrowed possibilities in people's conception. You're right. It's important to open those up.
Right. Well, Norm, we're going to hear from another track of Seattle 1919 opera, rock opera. This track is The Promised Land. Do you want to say anything about it?
Yeah, this is Anna Louise Strong at the end of the Seattle General Strike. We're back to Anna Louise Strong. The strike is over. It'd be interesting to talk about why, because one of our themes also was what constitutes a victory and what happens to those victories. But she's leaving. She's leaving on a boat now. She's going to cover the Russian Revolution and ultimately the Chinese Revolution. And this is her farewell. She's singing, she's heading off to the Promised Land.
Peter, get moving, grab your coat and hat. Going down to the harbor to the ticket shack. I'm going fast as I can. Gonna book me a passage on an ocean queen. There's a new world coming that I've never seen.
And now here's the Old Mole's Clayton Morgeridge.
Thanks, Lori. Well, I'm going to be reading a piece about the need to go beyond the Democratic Party's interest in voting rights to the interests of all of us in democracy, including the interests, of course, of workers in legislation that would be favorable to unions. This piece is by Megan Day, and it appears on the Jacobin Magazine website. The last few years have seen liberals intensify their focus on voting rights, and with good reason. In 2013, the Supreme Court stripped away protections that had been offered under the Voting Rights Act since 1965, and 14 states responded by installing new voter restrictions. While hardly the only contributing factor to Trump's victory, these measures may have had a crucial effect in swing states. Meanwhile, Republicans have stepped up their efforts to gerrymander state and federal legislative districts, reducing political competition even further. In the wake of the election, voting rights protections have become a top priority for liberal advocacy organizations and super PACs. Of course, liberals with their Democratic Party loyalties have a vested interest in targeting certain types of political repression. Strict voter ID laws, for example, are designed specifically to disenfranchise sections of the Democratic Party's voter base. Young people, people of color, and the poor, all of whom are less likely to hold a valid driver's license. That helps explain why Republicans tend to support such laws, while Democrats generally oppose them. As for gerrymandering, in recent years it's been wielded mainly against Democrats by Republican state legislatures, but in earlier eras it was the other way around, with little complaint from Democrats. The liberal focus on voting rights may be self-interested, but it's also to the good. The product of wrestling control of society from capitalist elites hinges on the ability of concerted majorities to control the state, and that requires that everyone be able to participate in the democratic process on equal terms. But we can't be satisfied with liberals' limited efforts on this front. The American political system is rife with hidden and not-so-hidden mechanisms designed to limit popular power. Most of these go ignored by Democrats. Take the example of local elections. Voter turnout in local elections is a national scandal. Not only is it dismal, it's declining. Across the country, less than 15% of eligible people vote in local elections. In Dallas's 2015 elections, only 6% of those who could vote for mayor did. Their median age was 62. Compare that with Spain's 65% turnout rate in its most recent elections, or France's turnout election rate of 64%. Now, low turnout is no accident. It's the intended result of state laws that schedule city elections in off years and off months. One California study, which found that an alarmingly small percentage of California residents decides local elections, concluded that about half the difference in voter turnout across California cities can be traced to a single factor, election timing. And there's nothing new about this. The manipulation of election timing was a regular feature of political party strategy in the 19th century, concludes a study by Stanford political scientist Sarah Anzia. At the dawn of mass political party organization, as restrictions on white male suffrage crumbled and party elites sought patronage to build their organizations, election timing manipulation emerged as one way to exert some control over the electorate. From the start, then, off-cycle elections were designed to reverse the trend toward greater democratic participation brought about by expanded suffrage. The solution is to change the laws. As many different offices as possible should be consolidated into a single election day. And while we're at it, election day should be a federal holiday. Political scientists consistently find that turnout goes up when races are close and when people perceive major differences among the candidates. Yet huge numbers of races around the country aren't even contested by one of the two major parties. Many more lack genuine competition, particularly in Congress. This is due to our continued reliance on winner-take-all elections. There's nothing inevitable about voting for a single candidate for a single seat. Doing so in a context of massive two-party polarization, especially given Americans' tendency to cluster geographically within politically homogeneous areas, guarantees uncompetitive elections. splitting up states into regions that are much larger than the small districts we currently use, and then voting for multiple candidates in those regions using a more open process like ranked choice voting would be much better. Within a larger field and multiple victors, there's absolutely no way to confidently predict which candidates are going to win. Every race is competitive, and you end up with a more accurate representation of the voters overall. A bill introduced to Congress this year would do exactly that. Eliminating winner-take-all elections could have an important effect for democracy. It could help loosen the stranglehold of the two official parties. The majority of Americans want a third major party, but there's currently no room for one to thrive. That's partly due to our winner-take-all election system, but it's also partly due to America's repressive system of party regulation. Since roughly the 1920s, the two parties have set draconian rules regarding what political parties need to do to get a ballot line, while generously exempting themselves from the requirements. Most states dictate that a party needs a certain number of signatures to get on the ballot, but exempt any party that won more than a certain percentage of the vote at the last election. That type of rule obviously perpetuates the dominance of the two established parties while extinguishing electoral competition, exacerbating partisan polarization, and driving down turnout. The left has a tendency to cede ground to liberals, gravitating towards political niches where it can differentiate itself, but that lie outside circles of real power. This often leaves behind a vacuum. Policies that are natural and strategic for leftists to advance are neglected because they fall under liberal jurisdiction. In the case of voting rights, the Democratic Party is primarily interested in electoral reforms that aid its central project of consolidating and retaining party power. It's up to the left to demand changes that benefit democracy itself. Today, many socialists aspire to create a mass, independent, socialist political party that will fight for the working class against capitalist interests and the major parties in their thrall. But how will such a socialist party find its footing if the very people it seeks to build into a constituency are boxed out of the political process by design and minor parties are deliberately relegated to the margins? If we're serious about creating conditions in which a new anti-capitalist politics can flourish, we can't leave it to the Democrats either. I've been reading from Megan Day's article, Beyond the Liberal Voting Rights Agenda, published on the Jacobin Magazine website, and I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks, Clayton. And Norm, I guess this is another example of how the ruling class became so much more effective after World War II. I mean, in 50 years after the Voting Rights Act was passed, we see how people are shut out of the electoral process and what possibilities arise, too, from a new kind of politics that might tap into the possibilities that your labor history workshop was exploring.
In a couple of different ways. One, of course, is does the labor movement need to be tied to the Democratic Party? Should we have a labor party of our own? That was a motif I would have liked to have explored in that course much more had we had more time. But the second thought I have in listening to Clayton is when I hear democracy, it's much more than voting possibilities or political parties. I want more democratic workplaces. And that's too is an objective of the kind of organizing that you, Laurie, and I were talking about earlier in the program.
Right. Well, thank you, Norm Diamond and Clayton Morgridge, Fran Michelle, and Patsy Kohlberg. KBOO keeps you informed and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on donate to become a member.
And listen to the Old Mole Variety Hour next week as well.
Nobody do me no harm, Lord. I wish I was a baby in mama's arms.